And now, the host of FNM Presents, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this May the 13th, Friday the 13th on the West Coast, and May the 14th, the day after Friday the 13th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. We'd like to welcome all those listening in also on Wind Talkers Radio Network, and I'm sure you're going to find tonight's show very fascinating. As usual, my regular guests on Friday nights and my co-host, scientist, inventor Jim Murray is with us, and as well tonight we decided to invite on the show for a roundtable discussion, essayist, metaphysician, intuitive, extraordinaire, Z.S. Livingstone, whose work is featured on Ken Adachi's site, educate-yourself.org. As you may know, if you've been listening to the show on a regular basis, we've been covering from time to time the Japanese earthquake, the tsunami, and what we feel has actually occurred there. And we're going to be bringing some damning evidence forth tonight. This is going to be damning to those who have been putting out nothing but propaganda and creating fear all over the planet, especially in the United States. And so a lot of truth is going to come out tonight. Why? We're going to talk about the earthquake, the tsunami, and behind the scenes what happened. Now, this is going to be a stretch for some people. We have a scientist with us tonight who understands physics, understands power production. Both guests actually do. And we're finding we were right on target with what's happening, and we're finding corroborating evidence. We were told that there was an earthquake, let's say a 9.0, 9.1 magnitude, whatever number you want to assign to it, a catastrophic event, and a tsunami. And our take, I say our take because in the shows that we did previously with Ken Adachi and Z.S. Livingstone, and separately with Jim Murray, we concur that something was rotten both in Denmark and Japan. And we're going to bring our guests on board, and we're going to discuss what we feel really happened and the evidence that we have been able to dig out from underneath the rocks and all the creepy places that they hide the truth. And we're going to bring it out into the daylight. First, I'd like to invite back to Evident Footprints my regular Friday night guest and co-host, our resident science advisor, as I affectionately call him, and a very dear friend, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Don. It's good to be back.
All right. It's great to have you back here. Now, before we go into a discussion, let's bring Z.S. Livingstone, Zero Nova Star Livingstone, on board. Z.S., how are you?
I'm great. It's great to hear Jim up and close and personal.
Yes, you gentlemen haven't met yet, so ZS, this is Jim, Jim, ZS.
Hello, howdy. Jim.
Good to hear your voice.
Good. Jim, do you want to comment on this event? Anything you want to comment on as far as it was delivered to us in the media before we go deep into the discussion? Now, I did give just a short summary of what we've been told, leaving out the fact that they're talking about radiation that's coming over here and what the source and the nature of that is. Anything you'd like to comment on?
Well, as you know, and I have mentioned on other shows, you know, I have friends in Japan. I've been over there probably seven times in the last few years, and I keep in touch. And I talk fairly regularly with this one individual, and this person was kind enough to tell me just a couple of days ago that traces of plutonium were actually found in the containment site, and that was not a material that should have been there under normal circumstances. And so they are now pretty confident that it was probably destroyed by a suitcase nuke that was smuggled in. And it was a part of a scheme. It was obviously a man-made scenario, the whole thing. And I think that Japanese people are very rightfully annoyed with this to the point where, you know, they're not doing anything to hide it. I mean, it seems to be common knowledge that they have been attacked, basically.
Yes,
and,
this is an act of war.
It's in the media. It's in the media, too.
Mm-hmm. It's in the media, yet we're getting a totally different spin on this in other parts of the world, aren't we? They've been filtering that out, obviously, preventing us from getting that information, haven't they?
Well, yeah, but not only that, I think that the entire thing was used for more than one purpose. I mean, it appears that the attack on Japan was to achieve certain ends, you know, with respect to that particular nation. But then in order to cover their tracks and to produce downstream damage, as it were, you know, this whole idea of the radiation plume and all of this other destruction that's going on was related to that as far as the news reports were concerned. But it may not have been a direct cause of that, if you understand what I mean. We
yes.
had discussed that on another show, where the possibility that, you know, airplanes have actually sprayed radiation into our own atmosphere here in the U.S. and then blamed it on the happenings in Japan. And what was interesting was, by coincidence, I was talking to a friend of mine in California just a few days after the calamity in Tokyo, and he happened to mention, we got on the subject of these chemtrails and whatnot, and he happened to have mentioned that the entire West Coast on that particular day, at least the area where he could see for quite a few miles, was just covered with these chemtrails, and he said the density of it was far more than what they were normally used to seeing. And I said, well, geez, that can't be a coincidence. You know, that's got to be part of something. And so yeah. It just all falls into place, at least in my opinion.
Yes. Now, the reason that we invited ZS on the show tonight, Jim, and ladies and gentlemen, is because he had intuited what had occurred, and he had written several essays that Ken Adachi posted on his website, educate-yourself.org. ZS, I have to make amends for not having all the titles memorized, because you were so prolific in seeing what went on and in intuiting what went on, regardless of the methods that you used to arrive at the conclusions and which enable you to discern what happened. So much of what you said corresponded with what I felt, with what Jim felt. And when you actually explore these pathways that our discernment opens up, we find corroboration, don't we?
Yes, you do.
And I'd like you to comment on, if you would, some of what you've written. And you know, you don't have to refer to the articles unless you care to, you sensed that there was an explosion in the Fukushima reactor. When Jim said the containment area, he was referring to the nuclear reactor that TEPCO owns. That's a facility that was built by General Electric, by the way. And we understand from various sources that it was not up to standards that would make it a safe place, but it wasn't faulty, is what you were saying. Would you expound on that, please?
There are very, very large reactors, some of the largest in the world, and they're kept up to standards. They're 30 years old, built in around 1980 era, and the containment buildings were built way over spec. They're built with steel structures instead of concrete.
Mm-hmm.
in order to survive large earthquakes, up to 8.5. And they did survive the 9.0, and except maybe one of the foundations might have been cracked where the water leaked. That, but also the cracking could have been caused by one of the suitcase nukes. The explosions went off in, almost like in time sequence. And from the very first explosion, I knew that that was not a hydrogen explosion. And they were just too big, too dark. The smoke was black.
Mm-hmm.
And the explosion, there was actually a mushroom cloud over reactor number 3, the one that was later said to be containing a fast breeder reactor, MOX fuel, MOX fuel, which is something that I as soon as I heard that, I knew that was an absolute lie. Japan would not be producing nuclear weapons grade plutonium in quick order. That's a Hanford sort of reactor, which is a very dirty reactor and very leaky. And Japan wouldn't do that. It's way against public opinion, and the government would not commit to that type of program or allow Tokyo Power to do that. And also, in reading up and studying nuclear reactors, well, since for over 40 years, reactors do not explode. They might melt down, and they might have hydrogen explosions, but the hydrogen explosions would be contained within the containment building. It might blow the doors out and some of the glass in the doors. But hydrogen would not build up to the point where it would be vented. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be too radioactive, and they'd just blow it right out of the building as fast as it was accumulating. And I don't believe that the earthquake caused so much damage, even though it knocked power out and also backup power.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been no problem for them to open up a vent, and they got the explosive conditions reduced. It's of course, hydrogen explodes with a clean blue flame, and the explosions were not a clean blue flame.
Yes.
And it's a fuel-air explosion. You have to get the exact, in the right parameters, a mixture of hydrogen with oxygen or air in the building to cause everything to go kapoof.
Now, if there was, let's say, a hydrogen explosion and there was water that had leaked into the building from the tsunami, that's part of the story. I mean, it's not been clearly stated if it was. And this leads to what we're revealing tonight, too. If there was a nuclear explosion and the smoke was black, it would say that something dry had caught fire. Okay.
Yes.
And in the case of water, it would be a white plume, would it not?
Steam. Yes.
Yes, it would come out as steam. You would see white plumes of smoke coming out of the hole in the roof. And right. The images, you know, I looked at the images of this, video images, and it reminded me of the phony shots that we saw of the Gulf of Mexico. The images are claimed to have been from a Japanese source, but it had that murky creature from the Black Lagoon look to it, you know, that you couldn't see a lot of detail. But I didn't see any fuel rods in the image. If there were rods there, and you had commented that there were no rods, you feel they had been removed.
Yeah, I was sent a picture taken by one of the helicopters, or maybe it was the hovering drone that was brought in, looking down on top of where the water had been drained out through a crack in the foundation,
mm-hmm.
and they had tried keeping the level up as much as they could. They actually had helicopters from the USS Ronald Reagan aircraft carrier, dumping water very messily in and around, but not inside the building very well.
We remarked that it sort of was spraying out of this helicopter as it flew.
That was supposedly light water, which no deuterium.
So was this heavy water that leaked out of the building, or is this water that was leaking out after the foundation cracked and the tsunami, let's say, surge entered the building? Do you know?
The containment water would be what they call lighter water. It would have had the deuterium or heavy water extracted from it, because deuterium acts as a moderator for neutrons, slowing it down and causing a sustained nuclear reaction. And that would, if you had heavy water inside the cooling ponds, then you would not be able to cool it down. The heat would continue on being generated.
Mm-hmm.
And so light water is very expensive stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It takes months and months to get even enough for a helicopter ride from the aircraft carrier.
Yeah. Now, Jim, if I can, and we're going to be bouncing back and forth, because I want to give you both an opportunity, to discuss this, Jim, your impressions on what ZS just said, because I think this is the first time you've heard him speak on these matters.
Well, I think before we even get into that, it's probably important to clarify something. I don't think most people are familiar with the layout of these plants. I used to work in a nuclear plant, and so, to me it's easy to follow what the other gentleman is saying. But there's the word containment is actually used in two different ways, and I think that should be clarified. There is a dome, that is usually reinforced concrete, sometimes steel, that encases the building that has the reactor in it. And, that's usually referred to as the containment dome. But then you've got, the other place where the spent fuel rods are put to cool and to go through their half-life cycle. And that's sometimes referred to as a containment pond or a containment pool. And I just don't think that someone who's casually listening would be able to make that distinction. I think we need to say which building is which, when we're talking about these things. That was my only observation. But other than that, I agree with what the gentleman said. And I can tell just by what he's saying that he understands the mechanisms involved and the purpose for the heavy water and all this other technical stuff. So far, everything is right on.
So this is not pseudoscience, is what you're saying. This is the real deal. Now, I congratulate you, ZS, on your take, because as we go in further into this discussion, we're going to reveal some other facts, some of which I steadfastly held to, and then Jim was able to corroborate some more things to show that some of the other things that you said in this regard were also very accurate, that we've got confirmation from the Japanese that they know what happened. They know what caused the tsunami. And before you jump in here, I just want to make a general statement. Because I was alerted to this event, and I was paying attention to what mainstream media was saying about it, because I just knew that it was something that I should listen to. And they were already predicting when the tsunami was going to hit. It was too scripted. They were giving schedules. It's going to be at Guam at this time. And then they described a few scattered islands in the Pacific. Then they said Hawaii, and they said the West Coast, and they were predicting this as if they knew the intensity of the tsunami instantly, but before any waves appeared. It was though the reports came out, and they knew by design, which explains how the tsunami occurred, not as a result of the earthquake. And we're not going to get into the earthquake yet. okay? We can refer to it, but we're not going to get into the what actually caused it yet. But regarding the tsunami, your impressions, share that with the listeners, and then I'd like Jim to add the information that he found out in that regard.
The tsunami came in 20 minutes after the 9.0 earthquake, and the distance offshore to the trench or where the earthquake was is about 80 miles. And the speed at which tsunamis travel is around 600 miles per hour. Do the math, it should be arrived in the, but that's on 600 miles an hour in open ocean at 10,000 feet depth. But when it comes close to the shore, it slows down a bit. And then as it gets right to shore, it starts building up and forming the white cap crest, the breaker. The 9.0 should have, it was an 8-foot shift of Japan towards Asia. And with any changes in the topography of the ocean bottom, where it's stretched out or lifted up or dropped, will cause a cavity into which water falls and then slops around and creates the seismic ocean wave. And since the earthquake came in 10 minutes later than that, the 9.0 did not cause the earthquake or cause the tsunami. It appears that the tsunami was caused by a 6.0 earthquake in the Japanese trench at about 10 to 20,000 feet depth. About 10 minutes later. And the seismogram on that explosion or that earthquake shows an explosion underwater.
An underwater explosion. Okay, I'm going to stop you right there before we go into the math or talk about what the probability of the tsunami being a certain intensity and how fast it was going. Only someone who knew when it was going to begin that whole process that you just described would be able to calculate the time, right?
Right.
Okay. Now, Jim, share with the listening audience, first of all, any comment about what ZS said. I'd like you to talk about what you've learned also from the people in Japan as to what they've determined was the cause of this tsunami.
Well, there was a deep sea drilling ship that was spotted off the coast of one of the islands, not too far from ground zero of the effect, and it has apparently been determined that they had drilled a mile deep hole in that area. And it is now pretty clear that some type of an explosive device, probably nuclear, was lowered into that shaft and ignited. And in my opinion, if that turns out to be the case, and they seem pretty confident that it is, that would certainly give plenty of impetus to create a tsunami in that region. And of course, if this whole thing were orchestrated, you know, the tsunami, the earthquake, the blast at the building, then all these things would have to have been carefully choreographed, and that, you know, that automatically suggests massive conspiracy. There isn't any way that you can call it natural, and there isn't any way that you can call it coincidental. It's a plan.
Yes. Yes. Now, I just want to comment. Think now about the earthquake, folks. In other words, this explosion was timed to go off at a certain time, so somebody knew the earthquake was going to take place. That's all I want to say. Right there. ZS, you want to comment a little?
Well, the earthquake was 3:11 on 3:11, and it was like the occultists who planned it were looking for the numbers that they wanted. And on the seismogram for the 9.0, you can see that up to about the initial event was an explosion up to 7 on the Richter scale, and then that caused a tectonic slip along fracture zones. So they knew exactly where to place another explosion in order to cause a shift on the tectonic plates of built-up pressure, which was the 8-foot move of Japan towards Asia. And they gave it a kickstart up to 7.0, and then massive amount of energy that came rolling out for the next 5 to 10 minutes, causing shaking, which is in Tokyo and all along the coast there, Miyagi Province, or that just is, was an earthquake that wouldn't stop, and that was there was tectonic pressure which they had located and knew how to release.
Mm-hmm. Now, my understanding is that, and my intuition tells me that the tsunami, if we determine it was an explosion, had a tremendous impact in its downward movement. Is it possible that the hole that Jim described was drilled in which to place that nuclear device was not as deep as you say, but that the explosion actually caused a downward continuation of that path of the original hole?
They actually tried over the next month, the rest of March, there was over 1,200 earthquakes over 4 on the Richter scale, and many of them were in the 5 and 6 range, and the layout of the earthquakes along the whole 200-mile-long coast from about 20 miles out to over 100 miles out, the whole area was just peppered with artificial earthquakes. 80% of the earthquakes were artificial, mostly in the 4.7 to 5.1 range at specific depths of 10 kilometers, 35 kilometers, and some a little bit deeper. But talking before about that appears to be the earthquake machine of targeted energy.
Mm-hmm.
To certain that hits a certain frequency to certain depth.
Yes.
Over 4 years, I've been tracking the 10 kilometer deep or 6.2 mile deep earthquakes, which since 9 of these type of earthquakes happened in the Canadian archipelago, right near where the North Magnetic Pole is, 4 years ago, and knowing the seismic action of the archipelago up there is almost nothing, and then you have 9 earthquakes, 4.7 to 5.1, all at 10 kilometers deep, forming actually a square grid pattern in an area off the slope of the archipelago. I knew it was totally artificial, and I suspected that they had drilled and put nukes down as far as they could.
Mm-hmm.
And my theory on that was actually what they're trying to go for deep oil,
mm-hmm.
which they later did in the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah. It's possible that that the hole was widened, maybe. Maybe it was deeper, you know, but it was widened to put this weapon at a certain depth.
You know? They can produce. I'm not sure on the. I've never actually physically been near a nuke, but.
Oh really? I saw one.
I don't have that expertise other than watching the movies, but could. Jim, could they put a cylindrical fission nuke, which a Hiroshima 20 megaton to 100 megaton bomb, down an 8-inch hole?
Well, that's a good question. I can only stretch my imagination to give you the answer. But before I do that, I don't think that we're limited to eight-inch holes anymore. They've got even horizontal boring capabilities now that can put, you know, even much larger, up until maybe 12, 14, 18-inch holes down. And some of them are done deliberately, you know, for the sake of putting casements and all kinds of other stuff down. And, of course, it's used primarily for the oil industry. And they've got these guided drills that can actually go in an arc, and they can go, you know, at an angle. They're pretty sophisticated. So okay. I wouldn't say that we're necessarily limited to a four or an eight-inch hole. But let's assume for a moment that we are. People who spend all their spare time designing nuclear weapons could probably come up with a geometry of a long, skinny bomb if they wanted to. I mean, the material has to be there, and the trigger mechanism has to be there. And they don't necessarily need the same type of a yield. What I mean by yield would be the conversion efficiency from, you know, from the primary fissionable material into actual electromagnetic energy. The yield doesn't have to be as high as it would be, for instance, if you were trying to demolish a city in order to get the effect, because everything is going to be magnified by the rock strata and the containment of the hole and the propagation of the vibrations, you know, through the tectonic plates. So my guess would be, if you've got billions of dollars at your disposal and you're nuts to begin with, there's no reason why you couldn't make an investment in whatever type of explosive device would be necessary to achieve your objective.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'd like to comment on something, because Jim said something that reminded me of another aspect of this. And this was just shortly before this event occurred. On one of my shows, I revealed that I had discovered an underwater base at the northern tip of Japan. There's a strait that moves to the north of there. And if you go due east, maybe 200, 250 miles or so, and I'm guesstimating the distance because I didn't actually measure it or calculate what it might be. I suppose I could intuit it. I've done it before very accurately, within a tenth of a nautical mile, actually to the tenth of a nautical mile, on two occasions, as far back as 1999. So I'm capable of doing it, is what I'm saying. But it's not necessarily the distance, but this could have been bored through access from this underground base, you know, using the nuclear boring machine and creating a large tunnel that they could bring this device in on large equipment to the actual location, and then take precautions to seal it off so there's no backflash going back through the tunnel. Or if it is, it can be neutralized somehow. But this is an alien base, the underwater base. And we shouldn't discount the fact that that possibility is there. So what Jim just said fits hand in glove with that. I was suspicious of the fact that this base might have had something to do with it. When we get into the earthquake, it even gets further out there. So either of you like to comment on what I just said?
Well, I don't know anything about that particular area, and I'll be honest with you, I don't have your gift of intuition when it comes to that sort of stuff. But I would kind of be suspicious of the nuclear-sized boring machine for one reason. That darn thing is so huge that if they were using something like that, I think that Japan is riddled with seismic detectors because it's a very active volcanic area. And yes. I think that a machine that big would probably set up some kind of a signature that could be detected by various seismic outposts.
Yeah.
I think that it would probably make more sense for them to use something smaller and more stealthy if they were trying to pull this off without being caught.
Yeah, well, they certainly could do it unseen by accessing, you know, the location of where they placed that explosive. And they could have done it in a way that it was very easy to prevent some sort of backflash, I'm calling it, a backward or a sideways exposure of that explosive material, because it's going to create a big hole too. It would be sufficiently far away that it may have had no consequences on the underwater base too. Maybe they didn't have to do anything to worry about that. But the point I'm making is, when you said that, it reminded me of that. And in fact, at the Google Earth location, at the surface of the water, there is some device that's purported, there's a photograph of it, actually. When you locate this base, there are also some picture icons, and you click on them, and they're right above the location you are. If you don't change your longitude and latitude by moving the picture around, you see what's on the surface of the water. And there is a device that's either a seismic sensing machine, or maybe a combination of that and like a tsunami warning machine, or a cyclonic alarm, if you will. I don't know what they use it for, but it happens to be on the surface right above that base. Would you like to comment, Jim?
Okay. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm kind of in the dark when it comes to that, to be real honest with you, but I would like to point out that even if all those things are exactly as you say, the most amazing thing is that this deep drilling rig, which is in the form of a ship, was actually seen and photographed, and as far as I know, they even have the name of the vessel. And, wow. That's at least a very tangible and obvious component in all of this. I really don't see how everything fits together. The only thing I can tell you is that regardless of how well engineered it is or was, it's certainly the work of madmen. That part's very obvious.
Yeah. But how deep can the boring machine go? I know that around 7 miles seems to be a limit. The whole casing would just collapse back down because of the plasticity of the rock at that pressure. Also, it's getting a bit warm down there. And would the nuclear boring machine or any sort of boring machine be able to create a sustainable hole at that depth beyond 6 miles?
Well, keep in mind that there's an alien base down there,
okay,
an underwater base. And if it's connected to that tunnel, they could have done some horizontal drilling, you see, to meet the vertical hole that Jim said the Japanese have discovered.
Okay.
You see, I'm thinking outside the box, but that kind of explains. So they could keep the temperature down, I think. And if you're going down at a slant with that machine, you should be able to go to any depth as long as it doesn't crush the machine.
Yeah.
That's a huge piece of equipment, and they've been using it for years. And maybe they're using something else.
Mm-hmm. How noisy those machines are, because you hear about the Kokomo hum, and you hear about the Taos hum, where they hear like diesel train type of noises constantly coming from the underground.
So there's tunnel going on, you're saying, or?
Yeah, or a lot of tunnel making, but it's definitely heard on the surface. The people feel that the deep underground military bases are 2 miles to maybe up to depths of about 3-4 miles. At the depths of these earthquakes and actually artificial explosions, we're talking from 6 to 20 miles deep. And so that's where I'd be suspecting that they have a pulse of some sort of beam weapon, which could be from space or nearby, hitting some sort of strata with a very high intensity microsecond blast in the nuclear range of energies.
Yeah. Now, I don't know enough about scalar weapons to tell you exactly what happened in that regard, but I can sense the timing of the weapon, and it's in the form of a pulse code. Okay.
Okay.
And it's scalar, and therefore it's difficult to direct the wave. But would it be a possibility, or had you had any impression on possible, let's say, like receivers, whether those would be crystals or some technology that might pick up that signal from space, in other words, and act as receptacles for desired resonance frequencies and amplitudes, maybe amplify it?
Well, there, one type of crystal that does happen at depth is olivine, very, very highly compacted silicate. And that might have the particular resonant frequencies that would accept the pulse and convert it to energy at that depth. When you're getting down to 20 miles, you're actually getting into the area where oil is being generated by the Earth, abiotic oil. And it could be that the pulse is hitting oil pockets at that 20-mile depth and causing
the Earth
thermal explosions from the oil.
Mm-hmm. Is it your understanding, maybe whether it's scientific or intuitive, that that would travel as a standing wave at some point with a particular resonant frequency?
I'm just seeing just a whole bunch of energy hitting there.
Mm-hmm.
Those deep earthquakes have more of a pressure wave, P wave type earthquake signal, and not too much of an S wave.
Mm-hmm.
Or the surface or lateral movement.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so it's more of a pressure wave.
Okay. Now, my intuition tells me, and I've held to this, I've listened to others' explanation for what caused the quake, but I had the impression, and a strong impression, not just from a perspective of being somewhere within the Earth's atmosphere looking down, but past the ionosphere, out in space where I could see the general area from where this came from. And this has been corroborated on several fronts, that there were weapons being used from space. And there are ways to track that and measure it and document it by observing data that had been collected. And it's not as though this was an event that was being watched and monitored as if someone knew it was going to happen, but because the infrastructure was in place to monitor all happenings, that it was able to be retraced, reviewed, okay, in the sense of looking at the time this happened and what certain readings would have been. Without going into technology or anything, I would presume that you're talking about an unimaginable amount of computing power.
Yes,
okay. Lots of data being collected and in ways that we haven't thought of collecting this data.
Yeah,
maybe maybe wishing, but not developed. Go ahead.
Well, the Department of Energy has been purchasing supercomputers for 30, 40 years. Of course, the 30-year-old supercomputers are laptops now. I remember reading newspaper reports where they're going to map out the whole stratigraphy under the United States using that supercomputer, and oil sample oil bore holes from oil samples plus seismic soundings plus all the studies which have happened regarding reading stratigraphy through looking at earthquakes themselves. And so they probably have 30 years of supercomputer technology for maybe how the ground lies up to 50 miles deep worldwide now. Maybe even they're, I believe that they're plotting right to the core, into the interior of the Earth, and seeing the topography at the core mantle interface,
mm-hmm.
which and they say surprisingly is a very stiff sphere inside the at about 4,000 miles depth.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what you're right about computing power. They've probably got gangs of supercomputers figuring out what's happening down there, and also they're probably also figuring out how to create a standing wave through simultaneous earthquakes in a cluster or a sequence, creating explosions on the standing waves, you're saying, and causing the Earth to ring like a bell. And so that would take a tremendous amount of computing power to see the seismic pattern of the standing waves worldwide inside the crust and inside the mantle. But then that you get into this Dr. Strangelove sort of stupidity of trying to trigger every single earthquake in the world, a Dr. Doomsday or a doomsday weapon, trying to release every bit of tectonic pressure everywhere all at once.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, considering that gives me a headache. It's just so psychopathic. It's hard to imagine why they would want to do that. But I'm also absolutely amazed that in the sequence, the time period during the 2 days before the March 11th earthquake, 9.0, and for up to today, there's still artificial earthquakes going off the coast of Japan, not as regularly as it was in the first month, which was almost like a clockwork every 10 minutes or so.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I believe 800 of them were artificial.
Yeah, I want to give you the opportunity to comment on what we've been saying here. But before I do, I want to just let you know, and this is for the listeners out there too, whether they're wearing white hats or black hats, that I can hear the tempo, the pulse, and the speed of the pulse. And if you could hear this energy as a sound, it would be like boom, 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 and just bursts like that, short but very, very compressed bursts of energy. And I see it expanding into standing waves as it hits the Earth and as it moves deeper into the Earth. So, Jim, would you like to comment on anything that you haven't in regard to what we've been saying over the past couple of minutes or so?
Well, the one thing that had resonance with me was your remark about why, you know, you're not sure why they're doing this. If these people are as psychopathic as I suspect that they are, and if they really have a concern that they might be losing control of their empire, you know, the attitude has always been, if I can't have it, nobody else is going to have it. And there's an enormous amount of information, and there has been for quite some time, about the fact that there are polar shifts that occur from time to time. And nobody knows exactly what sets them off. There's a lot of different theories about it, including the centrifugal force differentials that are caused by the ice packs at the poles and this type of thing. But apparently under certain conditions, there's a lubricating effect that occurs between the crust and the mantle. And if there's enough force involved, the crust can slip. And this, of course, rearranges the position of the outer shell of the Earth without necessarily interfering with the main mass of the planet. But the reason I bring that up is because if the shift is large enough, let's say it was a full 90 degrees, you would have just astronomical destruction, and it would be worldwide. It wouldn't even be local. And you're talking about, for instance, tsunamis that could easily be 3 and 4 miles high, and winds accompanying these water displacements, it would be in the neighborhood of 1,500 miles an hour. And you know, it's this type of thing that had occurred around the close of the last ice age. And these high winds and all this water displacement and the relocation of the tectonic plates and stuff like that as the Earth's crust slips has also been linked to the extermination of untold thousands of animals that were once, you know, living all together on the Earth in the late mammalian epoch. And, well, let's put it this way. They're just nuts enough to want to induce something like this, because it would certainly get rid of the so-called surplus population. But the irony of it is, even if they are down under the Earth in these tunnels that they've created and these subterranean cities, I don't think that their own probability of survival is too high. Because a slip like that, the one thing that that they may not be counting on is the fact that the equatorial bulge of the Earth has to be contended with. And if the crust slips in such a way that it moves across the equatorial bulge, all that landmass will just be absolutely chopped to pieces in the process. And, you know, this is one of the things that caused the Great African Rift. It's one of the things that caused the Grand Canyon and other enormous topological scarring, you know, in various parts of the planet. And, you know, they are, even if they do survive, they're going to come out to a very bleak and very different world.
Mm-hmm.
But my point was, you know, not to question, you know, why they're doing it, because I don't think that they necessarily understand their own cravings. If they're truly nuts, they're just nuts.
Mm-hmm.
But that could be one of the reasons why they've got such a repetitive pattern of blasts going on, you know, to get this one layer to the point where there is significant slippage. The irony of it is that there would still have to be a very large tangential force available to cause the actual impetus to twist. And I can easily see that the polar caps, particularly the one in Antarctica, because that's definitely anchored to a continent, as opposed to being a floating mass of ice, would have a significant bearing on this process under normal
yes.
conditions. But the so-called warming of the planet and the melting of the ice caps may actually wind up being a preventive measure in that respect. If it's
yeah. Now, coincidentally, there's knowledge that there's an underground base in Antarctica. So there, again, we have this anomaly of an underground or underwater base, all right? that has garnered a lot of interest lately. We know this is occurring, and I think we've talked about this on several shows too. Even you and I, Jim, have done shows on Commander Perry and Byrd, Admiral Byrd. Excuse me, I misspoke. Commander Perry's another whole other issue. But let me pose a question to both of you, and you can give either a scientific or an intuitive, metaphysical response to this, assuming that I am correct and all the data really has been discovered that there was a pulse beam or a scalar pulse or scalar weapon used to initiate all of these phenomena that result in an earthquake. And let's say one or more craft involved in a synchronous process orchestrated to in a timing sequence. You could do this off of one computer, or you could have synchronized clocks and just automatically initiate the process that it all happens at the rate it must happen or it's designed to happen, which could also be intentionally out of sequence, but at timed intervals between each ship firing the weapon. And since by its very nature, scalar weapons or scalar energy is a measurable quantity of energy that has magnitude, but it lacks direction. Is it possible that this was fired through a vortex, a natural vortex that exists as a means of maybe accelerating it or giving it direction? Would either of you like to comment on it?
I'll take a crack at that because I know a little bit about scalar technology, but actually, in order for scalar waves to really produce a large result, it really takes more than one, and they have to be at orthogonal angles, or at least at some severe angle. So the Russians played with this idea back in the 60s, and what they were endeavoring to do is to have two transmitters that would be able to transmit waves using great arcs of the Earth, and where these two waves intersected, the energy would be released thermonuclearly, but not as a result of an actual bomb. It would just simply be that the two scalar streams suddenly interacted and released their latent energy at that location, which is very interesting because it has the same effect as a thermonuclear weapon, except there's no delivery system, so to speak. So if these things were coming down from space, let's say radially with respect to the surface of the Earth,
yes,
in order to do the most damage, there would have to be a transverse wave somehow coming to intersect at that same location, and that would be following the contour of the planet as opposed to being radially disposed.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be something worth investigating if there was any way to do it.
Yeah,
find out if there was a secondary transmission site somewhere in the vicinity that could have contributed to this.
Yeah, well, I know there was more than one craft, which was why I proposed that this was either done totally in synchronization, 100% synchronization, or possibly to give a more chaotic effect to the whole thing. Maybe they were firing in a sequence, but not in sync with each other. In other words, in sync with the clock. Okay.
Well, I understand what you're saying, but what I'm trying to get the point across is that if their scalar technology is completely different from what we know,
yes,
there needs to be a second beam that is actually originating on the surface of the planet and intersecting the downcoming beam.
Okay.
And so you would have like one beam coming across the circumference of the planet and the other one coming down radially.
Okay. Could it be possible? You know, I'm not necessarily implying that all three craft are side by side, you know, that they could be on the opposite side producing that counter wave that you're talking about, that transverse wave.
Well, yeah, I mean, anything is possible. What this really all seems to be pointing to is the fact that in order for this to have happened at the magnitude and intensity that we're talking about, somebody off Earth is involved. And I think that that's where this whole conversation seems to be leading.
Yes. Well, of course, I'm not saying it was one of our craft. In fact, I say that it's not. And that was my initial impression on this. I have to give ZS credit for a lot of what he said. I looked at what caused the earthquake first, and I stayed focused on that for quite some time, and he was already looking at the nuclear aspects of this, you see, and he was very accurate. What you brought forth on the show tonight, Jim, corroborates what ZS has said. So we've got it from a metaphysical source, and we've got it from the people on the ground that are saying we've discovered plutonium within the reactor site, and it's not used. Plutonium's not used for manufacturing or producing nuclear power. So there's an anomaly there, and what CS said about that right out the gate and from the beginning. It's 100% accurate. Well, I have a question, and then, you know, ZS, maybe you'd like to jump in. As far as you know, Jim, has there been any adverse effect on the population because of the plutonium? Have they had to take any special precautions in regard to what they've discovered?
I'm not sure if anything specific was done on account of plutonium, because as you know, it's extraordinarily poisonous. But from what I understand, almost every citizen in every major city is doing two things. They have bought up all the Geiger counters available in the world, literally, and everybody has one. And in addition to that, they're all wearing face masks and filters and stuff like that. But God bless the Japanese. I mean, despite the problem, they're just going on with their everyday lives. So according to what I was told, women who are going shopping wearing these filtration masks, and they have a Geiger counter in their purse, and whatever they intend to buy, they take readings of the vegetables and stuff like that before they purchase them.
Well, gentlemen, I want to give you both a chance to make a closing comment, but before we do this, I want to give you the opportunity to gather your thoughts. Now, and I want to preface this, I'm going to play a song, if you can't tell, to give us that opportunity. The information that came out tonight, you know, we're not asking anyone to believe us. If you do the type of research from really a multidimensional perspective, we go by our intuition, and we trust that God directs us to understand these things, whether it's from a metaphysical or a scientific perspective. Jim is a very spiritual person, and he understands scientifically what he's saying spiritually, and likewise. He understands the opposite methodology as well. He can approach science from a metaphysical perspective and combine the two, and that's really understanding the true nature of God. And we can look at this event and the timing and all of the things that led up to this, and the evidence shows that it's not what they've told us. period. What has occurred has not been what they've told us, other than that there were many earthquakes and there was a tsunami. They even put out a second tsunami warning at one point, but my understanding was nothing happened. That was just to put more fear out there. And they put the fear of radiation, but they're not telling us the nature of the radiation. If the plutonium is traveling eastward and has reached Canada and the U.S. and at least Central America, depends on what is really going on there, the obfuscation of the chemtrails and all of that. So we're adding information here that you haven't heard, but it corroborates with what we told you over the past month and a half on a series of shows that I did with Ken Adachi and Z.S. Livingstone, or just Z.S., or just Jim Murray. We've all talked about this numerous times. And we said we were going to find the truth in this. You have to accept that this is a reality. It all connects to space every time, folks. I've been saying that for some time. And my guests agree. These trails all lead to what's going on in other parts of our solar system and across the galaxy. And I said on the show last night that it's like a freeway up there. It's like the German Autobahn or the center of Milan, Italy during rush hour. The traffic is enormous and the battles that are going on there. And there are those here who are doing what they can to put an end to all of this madness. But you've got this struggle for planet Earth going on. And Japan is a very desirable area. And it does have an underwater base off to the eastern, northeast, or northern tip of Japan to due east, several hundred miles east of there. It's just too coincidental. And the scientific information that Jim brought forth tonight even corroborates other things that are going on and could be used in conjunction or could have been affected by what has happened. So, gentlemen, I don't mean to sound so long-winded. You've brought forth most of the information tonight. I want to give you both the opportunity to make a closing comment after we consider Otis Redding's thoughts before the tsunami and the earthquake hit. Otis Redding said it many years ago. It's amazing how that song fits this story. You can picture a tsunami. He's naming the mileage and, you know, just describing the scenery. He's into the moment. And that's what we get into when we see these things from a metaphysical perspective. Certainly. Gentlemen, would you care to comment with the audience, your closing remarks? Just to make it easy, Z.S., would you like to start off?
Okay. If I was in the dock of the bay and suddenly the water retreated rapidly, I would be moving as fast as I could to high ground. I would not be watching what was coming in next.
Mm-hmm. No, he said.
Well, you got minutes.
Yeah, he said, look like nothing's going to change, you know.
Okay.
The waves were only a foot and a half on the west coast of the United States and Canada, from what I was told.
Yeah.
So it wasn't this predicted wall of water that was going to come in here. They didn't get the effect they wanted. But go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt. I just wanted to comment on that.
So going to your idea of energy being stargated from light years out from other star systems, the math on it would be incredible. If you have, you'd have to have multiple portals to get the angles proper from different points on the planet. You'd have to calculate the time distortions through hyperspace or whatever medium you're going to call it. But of course, if they're able to jump from other star systems in the split second to here, they would have that type of technology.
Mm-hmm.
So you're picking up intuitively that is coming from, 10, 15 light years out.
Well, there's that possibility. Certainly the people are from the 10, let's say 10 lightning out. Now, they could be anywhere from that point up to, let's say, you know, outside of our ionosphere.
Right. Yeah, I tried looking at orbiting craft. I tried looking at the moon. I tried looking at other systems. And when you consider the rotation of the Earth, the you either had to have the craft inside the atmosphere, say at the ionosphere level, mm-hmm. or at geosynchronous level to have that continuous barrage of energy beams every 10 minutes like clockwork.
Yeah, because you're saying it would take the shape of the ionosphere and probably be dispersed, you know, before it got to the depth they wanted it, right?
Yeah, right. It had to be inside the atmosphere to have some of the more intense scalar effects.
Okay. All right. Anything else you'd like to add before we have Jim make his closing remarks?
Okay. Well, trying to read rents.com, it just turns my stomach now, the amount of fear that's being generated on that website. It's not in regular media, they're not talking about it, but a lot of people are going to rents.com to get a fix on fear.
Mm-hmm.
They have to get their adrenaline rush today, and it's the science there is very questionable. They're saying a possible meltdown. If you had a meltdown, you'd have a steam plume coming up from deep in the earth, to which would look like an Old Faithful geyser on continuously, a white plume of steam,
yeah.
which would be highly radioactive. You wouldn't want to be anywhere near that site, and that's not what we're seeing at Fukushima.
Mm-hmm.
It's just they'll see a little puff of smoke or steam from something, mm-hmm. and say, "Oh, that's the meltdown." But a real meltdown, you're having tens of tons of fuel coagulating into one molten ball somewhere in the water table. You'd have steam and smoke.
Yes.
And that's not happening. And people are working in and around the plant, cleaning up the roads in paper suits with breathing apparatus. So they're not getting the hard radiation at all. They're not getting high quantities of radiation. The place is being cleaned up.
Mm-hmm. I have to comment, and I have to, again, congratulate you on the tremendous amount of attention you put on this and the work and the truth that you brought forward, because this all connects. It really does. It makes sense that what the Japanese have disclosed to their people and has been kept from the rest of the world is in line with what we have been saying and what caused this. The timing, folks, is just off the charts. 311 on 311, that's an Illuminati formula. That's a secret society, Masonic formula. You know, satanic. And so from a metaphysical standpoint, the numerology even has their signature on it. Jim, your closing remarks before we say good evening.
Well, strangely enough, the Dock of the Bay happens to be one of my favorite songs from that time period.
Uh-huh.
And the irony of it is that every time I hear it, I think of more serene things. I think of the days I spent while I was going to college working on the waterfront in New Jersey. And many a time I ate my lunch sitting on the edge of the dock, watching the ships maneuvering in the harbor. So I really don't want to make a mental association between that song and the horror story that we're talking about.
Yeah, that was...
allow me a few shreds of pleasurable memories, you know, to fall back on here. But
yeah.
As far as the main content of the... information that was disclosed this evening, you know, I think that there's enough information already out there, not only from us, but from numerous sources, that if people really want to get a fear fix, all I have to do is start thinking about what these madmen are trying to do and come to the realization that we're the only ones who can stop them. The only difference between making that statement and actually taking action is the realization that if good people do nothing, evil always prospers. And if we want to sit around and wait and see what they've got in store, I can only assure you it's going to be something even worse. So I think everybody should start to consider how the human race can work as a unit and to rid ourselves of these insane monsters that call themselves the elite.
Yes, well said. Jim, I want to thank you and congratulate you on your efforts with your enormously busy schedule that you maintain, that you were able to follow through as we promised, and we'll continue to bring forth information as it comes to us. But this is certainly the opposite of what we have been told. And we've talked about this on past shows. Again, I want to congratulate both of you for the amount of work and personal effort and sacrifice that you have put into viewing this and considering from both a metaphysical and scientific perspective what had occurred, and investigative as well, because there's a lot of that went on. And I thank you both. I want to encourage you ladies and gentlemen out there listening in Radio Land, that you should go to Ken Adachi's website, educate-yourself.org, and on the second line, fourth link from the left is, or is it the fourth line? No.
Fourth line,
okay. Is it the second link from the left? Maybe I...
No, it's in, right in the middle.
Okay, but I think it's a little bit on the left side, fourth line down. The page links that are at the top of Ken's site and on every page. You can click on Z.S. Livingstone and read his essays, because he's put this in writing. He's documented this. He's brought it to us in real time tonight in the context of all this new information that has come out. And he's with us because his research and his discoveries are corroborating the information that we've gotten from the people on the ground in Japan. And these aren't people who are just out there twiddling their thumbs. They're people in the know, paying attention to what's going on. So I congratulate and thank you both for your contribution to Evident Footprints tonight. And may we all agree that we should be still praying for the people of Japan, for their healing from this catastrophe that was intentionally created from a multiplicity of fronts, and that we pray for their peace as well. And for those who were lost, the families who have lost loved ones due to what amounts to nothing more than extortion, blackmail, and sabotage leading to mass murder. Gentlemen, I want to say good night and wish you both a very pleasant weekend. You are permitted to respond if you care to.
Well, okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. I thought that the other gentleman was going to go first, but that's okay. So thank you for your good wishes, and you have a good weekend, too, and hopefully next week we can continue on with the revelation of more important facts.
Okay. Well, yeah, you are my co-host, so ZS is our guest tonight. That's why I let him go first. So, ZS, again, I wish you a great weekend, and I want to say thank you.
Okay. And sure wish to explore this deeper. There are other angles to go to look at metaphysically,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't appropriate to go into those tonight. Maybe another time we'll go into the other metaphysical actions as well.
Yes. Okay. Very good. Well, folks, that wraps it up. You've been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com and tonight's guests, scientist inventor Jim Murray, who is my co-host, and Zura Nova star Livingstone. You can read ZS's work at educate-yourself.org. I encourage you to do that. Very interesting stuff there. Special thanks to Wind Talkers Radio Network for broadcasting Evident Footprints. Over at BBS Radio tonight, we had Seth Hendrick on the sound. I'd like to thank Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join me next Monday night for another episode of Evident Footprints. In the meantime, I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.